Okay, this is the Walt Whitman podcast. We're looking at two big poems of his. First, this kind of monumental poem, Song of Myself. In general, what I want to say about it is that what we're dealing with here is Whitman talking about himself, yes, but also think of him as the center of a series of concentric circles. In the very center, the smallest circle is Whitman himself. And yes, he's talking about himself here. Right, 52 paragraphs, it's kind of tough to look at these and think that they are stanzas or anything like that. He calls them paragraphs. So we've got 52 of those that are all about Walt Whitman, the person. But we've also, he expands these out to be all about America. Right? The title itself, Song of Myself, is significant because he's representing all America. The book it comes from is called Leaves of Grass, and this was a volume that he worked on over and over and over again. I think 9 editions came out in his lifetime. What he was trying to do there was he talked about, because he's alive and he's writing at the time during U.S. westward expansion, and he's talking about the great grasslands, the savannas, the plains of the American Midwest, right, the prairies as we would call them, and how when you look at a distance, all those leaves of grass appear collective and huge and innumerable. But get up close and you realize that they're all individual and they're all different. They're all unique. So this idea of leaves of grass, of course, has got some kind of biblical baggage there with those leaves of grass, too. All flesh is grass and it fades like the flowers. Right? There's an emphasis on life and the, you know, the cycle of life and death and the inevitability of our mortality. But he begins, well, those are the first two descriptors for this, right? And the third and final circle is kind of all humanity. And he makes that point over and over again. As he says, I celebrate myself and sing myself. These are the very opening lines in the first paragraph. And what I assume, you shall assume, for every atom belonging to me as good belongs to you. So if you've taken a look at that, that secondary Whitman page, you saw that quotation from Bill Bryson and saw the number of atoms that were in you. And Whitman was aware of this, right? Every atom belonging to me as good belongs to you. We know this from physics, right? Matter is neither created nor destroyed. It's just reused. Right? So we are all at some level, at the atomic level, connected. And that's the communion he wants. People kind of obsess over Whitman's sexuality and how sexually active he was. He'll settle for sex because that's the closest you're going to get to another human being physically. But what he really wants is this connection on an atomic level. He says, my tongue, every atom of my blood formed from this soil and this air, born here, of parents born here, from parents the same and their parents the same, right? Now I'm going to start, right? I'm going to bring you nature without check, with original energy. And then your book has very few of these 52 sections here, and not even all the full paragraphs themselves. But I want to look at paragraph 7 as well, where he gives us that we get kind of a clue into his poetic technique and also this kind of inclusivity that he's all about. His poetic technique, he uses, we would say that he could use rhetorical devices, and those are techniques that you use for writing in order to convince somebody of something or present something. But actually, Whitman, and we're going to see Douglas later, use oratorical devices, devices we'd hear in a speech, rhythm, repetition, kind of emphasis over and over again. So if you look at that paragraph 7, every kind for itself and its own, for me, mine, male and female, for me, those that have been boys and that love women, for me, the man that is proud and feels how it stings to be slighted, for me, the sweetheart and the old maid, for me, mothers and the mothers of mothers, for me, lips that have smiled, eyes that have shed tears, for me, children and the begetters of children, undrape. You're not guilty to me, nor stale, nor discarded. I see through the broadcloth and gingham, whether or no, and am around, tenacious, acquisitive, tireless, and cannot be shaken away. So this section here, like we saw that kind of list, right? Here are the people I want for me. And it's totally inclusive. Male, female, boys, people that love women, men that are proud, men who are not proud, or how it stings to be slighted, the sweetheart, the old maid, mothers, the mothers of mothers, right? This repetition, every line, for me, this is the kind of thing we'd expect in a stump speech. We'd expect something inspirational. And so he's playing this up, using this technique as a way to organize this text here. And what he tells all these people, undrape, literally, take off your clothes. You're not guilty to me. All those dark secrets you have, remember, we share the same atoms. We share the same ideas. We share the same humanity. Right? You're not guilty. You're not stale. You're not discarded. And I see through then there's broadcloth and gingham. Broadcloth, typical 19th century American clothing for men made with broadcloth. Typical 19th century clothing in America made for women, gingham. I see through you. I have X-ray glasses. Why? Because you look exactly the same as I do. All those deep, dark secrets you think that nobody knows, I know them, right? Undrape. You don't have to hide. I'm just as bad as you are. I'm just as good as you are. And I'm there. I'm ready to see you, right? And he tells us later on in paragraph 16, he makes it very specific. And as Georgians, we should pay attention to this. One of a nation of many nations, the smallest the same and the largest the same. A southerner soon as a northerner, a planter nonchalant and hospitable down by the Oconee I live. A Yankee bound my way, ready for trade, my joints the limberest joints on earth and the sternest joints on earth. A Kentuckian walking the vale of the Elkhorn in my deerskin leggings. Louisianian or Georgian, a boatman over lakes or bays or along coast, a Hoosier, Badger, Buckeye, at home on Canadian snowshoes or up in the bush with fishermen off Newfoundland, at home in the fleet of ice boats sailing with the rest and tacking, at home on the hills of Vermont or in the woods of Maine or the Texan ranch, comrade of Californians, comrade of free Northwesterners, loving their big proportions, comrade of raftsmen and coalmen, comrade of all who shake hands and welcome to drink and meet. A learner with the simplest, a teacher of the thoughtfulest, a novice beginning at experience of myriads of seasons, of every hue and caste am I, of every rank and religion, a farmer, mechanic, artist, gentleman, sailor, Quaker, prisoner, fancy man, rowdy, lawyer, physician, priest, I resist anything better than my own diversity. Wow. I mean, talk about making himself American. He's all over the country. Here he's in the South. He's in the North. And remember when he's writing where there are real divisions there, right? But what does he single out? Down by the Oconee. Yes, that river in Georgia. In fact, two lines later, he's going to mention Louisianian or Georgian again, right? Mentions Georgia twice here. Interesting. Californians, free Northwesterners, Maine, Vermont, Texas, Hoosier, Badger, Buckeye. And then he says, look at us. We learn with the simplest and we teach the most intelligent. I'm just starting out and yet I know everything. I'm of every hue, right? Every color, it doesn't matter. Every caste, every social class, of every rank, of every religion. You name it, this is America. I resist anything better than my own diversity. And how does he organize it? Rhythm, repetition, over and over and over again, until we get to like 24 when he says, I'm the entire universe, Walt Whitman, a cosmos of Manhattan, the sun, turbulent, fleshy, sensual, eating, drinking, and breeding, no sentimentalist, no standard above men and women or apart from them, no more modest than immodest. I'm just like everybody else. I don't stand above everybody else, right? But whoever degrades another degrades me. And whatever is done or said returns at last to me. I speak the password primeval. I give the sign of democracy. By God, I will accept nothing which all cannot have their counterpart of on the same terms. It's the ultimate democratic sentiment, right? That we are all equal before the law. And we see go on like this over and over again. And then at the tail end, right? Let's look at paragraph 46. He gets to a point where he's trying to carve out a little space here for the poet himself. He says, I tramp a perpetual journey, right? I have no chair. Let's look before that, right? No friend of mine takes his ease in my chair. I have no chair, no church, no philosophy. I need no man to a dinner table, library, exchange, right? He says, He says, I'm not preaching to you. I'm not taking it. I'm not giving you accumulated wisdom. I'm not giving you something to believe in. I'm not giving you a way of thinking, right? Here's what I'm doing. But each man and each woman of you, I lead up upon a knoll. My left hand hooking you round the waist, my right hand pointing to landscapes of continents and the public road. Not I, not anyone else can travel that road for you. You must travel it for yourself. It's not far, it's within reach. Perhaps you've been on it since you were born and did not know. Perhaps it's everywhere on water and on land. Shoulder your duds, dear son, and I will mine. Let us hasten forth. Wonderful cities and free nations we shall fetch as we go. He says, this is what the poet does. I stand there on a knoll, on a grassy hill, looking out over those leaves of grass, looking out over those great prairies. And I take you and I put one arm around your waist. And what I point to is the future. I point to the west. I point to the public road and tell you, I can't walk this for you. But we have to do it, right? You have to travel it for yourself. I can show you that it's there, and I can show you that you can make choices, and I can show you that we are in common because we all stand here, right? We will see wonderful cities and free nations as we go. Right? That's him, the job. That's for him, the job of the poet. It's also kind of the job of the American. It's the job of the human, right? Until eventually he says, listen, I know that you're going to say that this poem's long and it makes no sense. And I know that you're going to say, as America is confused, we're not blue, we're not red, we're kind of purpley or whatever. Do I contradict myself? Very well, then I contradict myself. I'm large. I contain multitudes. We should expect contradiction and self-contradiction in a place like America, in a species like humanity. Until finally, at the tail end, he tells us, right? Nature itself, the spotted hawk, swoops by and accuses me, right? He says, I've been waiting too long, right? I'm not tamed like that, but I'm going to go away just like them, and I bequeath myself to the dirt to grow from the grass I love. If you want me again, look for me under your boot soles. You will hardly know who I am or what I mean, but I shall be good health to you nevertheless, and filter and fiber your blood. This is, again, right at the very end of the poem, and this really is literally the last six or eight lines of this poem here. He comes back to the very beginning, right? Every atom belonging to me as good belongs to you. Well, here, right, I will eventually decompose into the grass that I love. If you want me again, you're walking on me, right? And as Bill Bryson tells us, you're breathing me in. I will filter and fiber your blood. I shall be good health to you. Failing to fetch me at first, keep encouraged. Missing me one place, search another. I stop somewhere, waiting for you. Well, we know, right, as Bryson tells us, we know where he stops. He stops within us, right? This is the kind of the genius of this. The second poem we're looking at is Out of the Cradle Endlessly Rocking. And we've got this story here of it's a really kind of sad story, right? A little boy, Walt Whitman, who grew up on Long Island, you know that if you read the bio stuff, witnesses the death of a bird. Well, he doesn't see the actual death of a bird, but he sees these migratory birds coming from a tern coming from Alabama, coming from the South, right? They have a nest, they have some eggs, but then the female bird dies. And the male bird spends the rest of the summer looking for his mate. And it's heartbreaking, and it brings him to tears, right, as a little kid. But what it does after it brings him to tears is really important. And the italic parts there that are in your text, those are the parts that the bird speaks, right? And he says it's a bird song. It's an aria. It's an official art song, right? The aria is sinking, all else continuing, the stars are shining, the wind's blowing, the notes of the bird continuous echoing, right? The yellow half moon, right? The boy ecstatic with his bare feet, the waves, with his hair, the atmosphere dallying, right? The love in his heart long pent, now loose, now at last, tumultuously bursting, right? And he figures out what this means, this sense of loss, this sense of pain, the sense of his own mortality, and he's kind of overwhelmed by it, right? And this connection of the sea with this and the death of the bird with this is really, really significant. Demon or bird, is it indeed toward your mate you sing, or is it mostly to me? For I that was a child My tongue's used sleeping. Now I have heard you. Now in a moment I know what I am for. I awaken already 1,000 singers, 1,000 songs, clearer, louder, and more sorrowful than yours. 1,000 warbling echoes have started to life within me, never to die. There is the poet saying, this is the wellspring of poetry. Now I know where it comes from. I have heard this pain and I want to give it voice. And the poem itself is what does this, right? You singer, you're projecting me and I'm projecting you every time. Never more shall I escape. Never again leave me to be the peaceful child, right? And never again will I let go of what I saw by the sea under the yellow and sagging moon, the messenger there aroused, the fire, the sweet hell within, the unknown want, the destiny of me. And then we get to this kind of significant susurration of the bay, Long Island Bay there, right? Oh, give me a clue. If I'm to have so much, let me have more. A word, right? What is this word, right? A word, as he says, stronger and more delicious than any other. Are you whispering it the whole time? Subtle, sent up the word final. And then the sea answers him. Where to answering the sea, delaying not, hurrying not, whispered me through the night and very plainly before daybreak, list to me the low and delicious word, death. Death, 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 death. Creeping then steadily up to my ears and laving me, washing me, bathing me, surrounding me softly all over. Death, 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 death. Which I do not forget, right? As he's going to say, that's right? This 1,000%, everything, right? This life that comes before it, right? When we're dead, we don't celebrate our death. When we're dead, are we even aware that we're dead? But we're alive now, and we should celebrate this, right? The word of the sweetest songs in all songs, that strong and delicious word which creeping to my feet, the sea whispered me. And if you look back at this poem, you see lots of contrasting imagery, right? Sea, the water of life, right? Out of the ninth month cradle, right? Out of the cradle endlessly rocking, right? Cradle, we think of it as in terms of the beginning of life. But here, yes, in the beginning of his life, he's becoming aware of the inevitable end of it. And so these two, I think, should give you some idea of kind of the significance of Whitman for just for world poetry in general, right? He's obviously incredibly romantic. The form is something we've never seen before. The emotions are just so exposed and so raw that it becomes incredibly significant historically, right? Contrast him to kind of the other great voice in American poetry at this time, Emily Dickinson, who's very meticulous and very measured. Entire books have been written on Emily Dickinson's use of the dash. Right, just the dash in her poetry, right? Whitman is just kind of the exact opposite of that. Larger than life, as he says, he sounds his barbaric yawp all over the world, right? He's so big. I'm convinced that you're either a Walt Whitman fan or an Emily Dickinson fan. Right? You either like that crafted, meticulous, right, very tiny and precise stuff, or you like this big, expansive, emotional, kind of overwhelmingly exploding material like we've seen here with Whitman.